Welcome to Fresno's Best Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today we have Reverend Simon Biasell on the show. Simon is the pastor of the Big Red Church and the co-executive director of Woven Coalition for Justice. For more than 20 years, Simon has worked to build the radical hospitality within faith-based groups and is passionate about connecting and organizing community members to speak truth to power. Simon graduated from Fresno Pacific Biblical Seminary with a Master's of Divinity. He and his wife live in the Fresno High neighborhood with their two children. Simon is a doctoral student at the University of Dubuque, where his research explores how the next generation of churches can best serve their communities. We get into a lot of insider baseball within religion, but then also a lot of topics that will be of broader interest to most listeners, whether you're religious or not. So I'd encourage in both types of listeners, those who have a connection to religion and those who don't, give this episode a try. I think you'll find a lot of topics fascinating to you. And you also might better understand the sources of some of the conflicts within religion. I know you'll find this conversation fascinating. Let's go meet Simon, and Baker will take us there.
To elevate guests, politics, religion, culture, art, music, show some respect to the best little city left in the U.S. Fresno's best! Fresno's best!
So, Simon, where do you like to eat in Fresno?
Ooh, I like to eat at Gazebo Gardens. We live in that neighborhood, and especially when our kids were really little, to be able to walk or scooter over to Gazebo, and they were in a closed place that could run around and was relatively safe. My daughter did twice in 1 year fall in one of the ponds, and so we had to walk back cold. And we don't do it as much anymore. I felt like the food was more exciting before. Like, I was really into the taco food truck, the Korean barbecue fusion truck. He is no more. I just ate at Mike's for my birthday on West and Shields. It's like an old-time establishment, Italian-American restaurant. My dad's side of the family is Italian-American, and my family makes deep-fried calzone, and they also make deep-fried calzone. And so everything about that place is nostalgic.
Do you get a textural difference versus baked versus deep-fried calzone?
Absolutely. Like, there's a crunch. There's a crunch that you get. And I think there's flavor wise for sure. But yeah, a good crunch that you don't get. So yeah,
those are some good recommendations. I also used to go to Gazebo more than I do now. And I think it's so hard with the food truck thing, you know, because I don't know what the turnover rate is relative to brick and mortar operations, but I imagine it's much higher at a food truck operation because it's so dependent on, you know, where, if people can find you and where you are and the weather and so many other factors that makes it high. And
I think also Mike Oz became kind of a food truck Don Corleone, and he wrangled all the food trucks away from Gazebo. That's a conspiracy. I don't know if I can confirm that.
No, actually, I think there definitely are turf wars. I would assume that that's true. We're going to jump into talking about religion, which is going to be the focus of this conversation. And I wanted to start by having you kind of share briefly your story of your relationship with religion, kind of where it started and how it got you to where you are now.
Yeah, I'm a third generation Presbyterian pastor. Both grandparents on my mom's side were ordained Presbyterians. They planted a Northminster Presbyterian church in Bakersfield. My dad was raised by a devout Presbyterian woman who served her congregations here in Fresno, Easterby Knox Presbyterian Church and Westminster Presbyterian. But by the time I was born, both of my parents rebelled a bit from their Presbyterian tradition and started going to a church called Valley Christian Center, which is a four-square denomination, kind of a charismatic church. And I was raised in that church for my childhood. And not only did we go to church there on Sunday, but there was a tight-knit community. I, as you might guess from a church like that, most of the moms stayed at home and didn't have full-time professions outside of the home. And so it was really normal for a group of us kids to get dropped off and babysat during the day at one person's house. And then a few days later, those kids would be at our house. And so raised in this community that I have really fond memories from, kids that I grew up with, I see and I have great memories. We left that church, and kind of maybe based off of my friends that did not leave that church, maybe we left just in time. And my dad, we returned to our Presbyterian roots, and my dad became the director of a Presbyterian summer camp outside of Oakhurst called Calvin Crest. And so then we would spend our summers at the camp. I would live up there. And again, there was this great community component to it. Kids from all over the West Coast would come for a week, and I'd make friends with them for a week. And then a lot of times they'd come back the next summer, and we all grew up together. And so a big part of it was just, it's the community that I grew up in, and the people that I knew and the people who raised me. The theological components of it and the practice of it, the religious practice, for the most part, I enjoyed and believed deeply from a young age. I was like a believer for sure, but I think always it was more about the community than what we actually, the religious practices. Like for me, running around the church after worship and playing tag and being told that we shouldn't be running in the halls and things like that. That's really valuable, that there was a space that we belong to. And so into my adulthood, I got hired. I hated school. I was always really bad academically. I struggled. Every year I would say, this is the year that I'm going to get a 3.0. That was my big aspiration. And always shy, usually about a 2.75 GPA. And so as soon as my parents could no longer legally force me to be in school, I stopped, and I got hired working with junior high kids at my church up in Oakhurst. And from there, I just kept getting hired and working at different churches. I worked at a church outside of Seattle in a place called Mercer Island, which was very different from Oakhurst, California. Then from there, worked at Hollywood Presbyterian Church, and then got hired at a church in Napa, First Presbyterian Church in Napa. And after Napa, I was done working for churches. I didn't have bad experiences, but I just kind of felt like church institutions put in 90% of their energy for a couple hours on Sunday. And for me, like I said, the community part was so valuable. And here we are investing in just us having a hangout space for 1 to 2 hours once a week, and thinking there is a more valuable way that we can use our resources. And not only did it transfer from just being able to have a community with people who belonged, but thinking about what is our role with justice. And that justice and faith have always been, even as a little kid, but probably before I could articulate it, like there was a strong connection. Like as a kid, I remember that there, like something about that Martin Luther King was a pastor, that made so much sense to me. And so over the years, that developed, and there's a number of components to it. But like I said, I wanted to stop working for the church when we came to Fresno. I wanted to work for a nonprofit organization, community benefit organization, But I got hired at Westminster Presbyterian Church. My first day there, I had this, everybody was so grateful that I was there. And I felt like, man, it feels so good to belong. And this is how it always is. Every time I go to a church or Christian community, like, wow, I feel like I belong here like I don't anywhere else. And then I realized all the people that I know that felt the opposite, that the church is the place where systemically they have been made to feel like they don't belong, and not just feel like they don't belong, but made it so that they don't belong. And so at that moment I said, I feel called to become ordained as a pastor. And then with that, to start a church where the folks who don't feel like they belong, belong.
Well, that's a helpful kind of trajectory setting, and also setting up context for some of the questions I ask you now. I'm going to kind of go thematically, starting with kind of seminary questions. As a seminary grad, I've got a number of issues and questions I want to talk to you about. But the first one I want to ask you is, let's say you've got an enterprising adolescent in your congregation who has decided at 18 they want to pursue a career of ministry, and they know they're going to go to seminary eventually, but they, you know, obviously want to get their bachelor's degree first, and they don't want to duplicate courses. What would you recommend that they study in their undergrad if they just came to you and said, I want to study, but I know eventually want to go to ministry, but I don't want to do the same thing twice.
And they're a high schooler and they think that they want to be a pastor someday.
Yeah, something like that.
You know, I think I would advise them against worrying about that in undergrad. I think undergrad is a great place to discover yourself, discover your intellect, discover other ways of thinking, discover other cultures, be challenged. I also think it's a great place to set yourself up for a well-paying job after you graduate. And so what I think is problematic is when people are only trained for ministry, and then maybe they go into ministry eventually, and then a lot of times that vocation comes to an end. They don't feel equipped for many other things. And also there's a lot of industries that don't see how the skills that they've developed in ministry transfer. So this maybe too not a helpful answer to what you're looking for.
No, you're just making it more nuanced, which I also agree with, that in some respects, you know, you should just go with what interests you, but also think about, you know, there's a lot of bivocational ministers out there that, you know, have a day job. I know a firefighter that's a bivocational minister in San Diego, and that's just kind of the nature of how he pays the bills. And, you know, and I think it also prepares you for the future, which is that, you know, churches change. Now, one of the things that is changing, and I went to Fuller Seminary, is that there's financial issues that are arising from seminaries, like a lot of universities. Can you foresee a world without seminary education?
Yeah, I mean, there was a world pre-seminaries where it was more of like an apprenticeship situation, where you would go work for a church and you would study under somebody in a local context. And I could see some value for that. Obviously, financially, it is harder and harder for these academic institutions to continue to pay their bills, with less and less people being interested in going into ministry. And then, like you said, in my world, in Presbyterian world, it was very normal that you would go to seminary, finish seminary, and automatically you were going to have a full-time job somewhere in the country. And more than likely you would have a few different offers that you would get to, or a few different options to choose from. And that's just not the case anymore. And so, yeah, I think we do need to be creative with how we are preparing people for full-time ministry. One of the great things also about seminary is that, I don't know if this was your situation, but a lot of people realize that in seminary that not only is ministry not the vocation that they choose, but Christianity is no longer the religion that they want to practice. And so...
Can I interrupt you? There is a hilarious thing. It was after I graduated, and a fellow alum sent it to me. Fuller put out this commercial where there was a bunch of people sitting around a table, And it was like what they're doing after their seminary education. Only one person at the table was in ministry. It's like a writer, an artist. It's like, you know, it's just, and you know, they kind of, the question you come in is like, what happens to these people when they arrive here? I can explain what happens to those people, but most people can guess what happens. Sometimes I do think it is hard for some people when you see how the quote sausage is made, you know, to retain the same level of, I don't know what the word is, authentic belief. Sometimes it can be hard to compartmentalize some of those things. And that was certainly my experience. It was hard to compartmentalize. Another question on seminaries, though, do you think we'll ever reach the point where we have gender parity?
In seminary or in?
In seminaries itself. Yeah. Yeah. I think it was when I was there, it was at least in the MDiv program, it was 70-30 or something like that. I could be wrong.
Yeah. I would be interested in other like mainline seminaries, what the numbers are. I mean, we don't have economic parity in almost any industry in this country, and like I think across the world pretty much. So
okay, I do have to correct myself because I just Googled Princeton Theological Seminary's gender parity, and it's 51% women. So that
was
my context.
I was actually thinking Princeton specifically. That like just thinking about folks that I know that go there and come out of that, that there is a lot of women. So. But yeah, one thing I heard, it was a seminar mostly around women in politics. And there were a number of politicians who were women on the panel. And they were each talking about how they had to be told multiple times by different people that they respected that they should go into politics. And somebody pointed out that usually for men, all they need is one person to say, you should go into politics. And the man goes, oh yeah, I should be a politician. But for women, it's something that has to be, that there's something that has to be untold to them multiple times for them to own it. And I'm sure that the same thing is in ministry, that if you have a mentor that says you should go into ministry and a man hears that, they would think, oh yes, I should be the pastor. I should be the one person who gets to speak predominantly during worship on Sunday. Of course that's me. But I think the same applies with that women unfortunately need to be told that they don't belong multiple times before a lot of them are able to believe that and to hear what I would say is a calling from God.
Yeah. And it seems like a big societal cultural problem, as you're suggesting. I've got a crude question now. And let's imagine that you were made the czar of the, you know, Fresno Pacific Seminary or whatever, and or any seminary. And they said, Simon, we want you to design some kind of final exam. It can be as long or as brief as you want, but they'll have to pass in order to graduate from the seminary. What would you put on that exam? What would you want pastors to absolutely know when they leave?
I would want it to be something like in the exam, they made some significant mistake, or they were being accused of doing something wrong or poorly, and they have to give their response to that. And because I think humility is such a necessary thing for ministry, and you have to be ready to have, I don't have a boss. I have however many people show up on a Sunday as my boss, like, and they all have opinions. And so you have to be in a place where you have to be able to receive criticism with humility and grace, and not give up and keep going.
Mm, that's a great one. One last question on education. I used to do this years ago when I would be looking at churches to attend. I would, and this is probably comes from a seminary background, I would look at the education of the person that I was going to be listening to preach a sermon on a Sunday, and then immediately pass judgment on an entire organization based on the education levels, which I recognize now is kind of, you know, 20-something hubris as someone that pursued a lot of education. But do you, let's say you go on a rant, you know, you're visiting a town, you go on a church website and you see that the minister at that church has no formal education. Does that worry you?
If I'm honest, yes, which I guess signifies that if I don't say that, I might be lying for the rest of my answers. Yeah, if I'm honest, yeah, it would concern me. And and I would probably be looking for somebody with an MDiv. However, I don't like when pastors, if they have a title, that their title is doctor. Like this is a, like that title is an academic title. And like, you could be a reverend, you could be pastor, you could be minister, father, dean, deacon, whatever it is. Those are ecclesial titles. It does get on my nerves when somebody, like, if you want to reverend doctor, that'll pass in my book. But if you, what you want to let people know is that you achieve something academically, that's little relevant for what we're talking about when we're talking about what a pastor should be doing.
Yeah. Well, it feels like peer review. Like if I've formed all my own ideas about something in isolation or in a position where no one can question my judgment because I'm the head pastor of a church, then that tells me that those ideas probably aren't as refined as they could be if you didn't have a group full of people studying the same thing and challenging you on different, you know, I remember my most significant seminary class was with this guy named Joel Green, and we did a lot of like literally me, him, four other people in a room arguing about Luke Acts for hours. And, you know, I had to really refine what I thought that Greek phrase meant. And there was multiple times
where Joel had it memorized.
Yeah, exactly. And he would tell me that my ideas were underdeveloped and stupid. And I would have to explain why I thought he was wrong, which is a terrifying prospect as he leans over his desk. We're going to jump now into kind of general church topics. Should head pastors of a church know how much individual people tithe?
I don't. And when people have tried to explain it to me of why they should, they say things like, oh, well, you know, giving is a spiritual gift, and you want to, and as a pastor, you should know how they're doing in that spiritual part of their life. Or if you're, so let me answer. I've got two examples, and I'll give you my opinion on each. There are so many components to how people are doing spiritually, and how much they give to the church that I'm the pastor of is a really small component of it. And I think that finances are really significant, that finances are obviously really complex, and people's personal finances are really complex. And so there used to be a time when the expectation is that somebody would give 10% of their income to a congregation, and that's how societies would take care of each other, because the church then was the social network for the community around it. Well, that's not the case anymore. The other component is this, like people will say, well, you're essentially the executive director of this organization, and any good executive director knows who the donors are and if they've been giving or not. The difference between the executive director of Habitat for Humanity and their relationship to their donors and my relationship to my congregants is when somebody is on their deathbed, they don't call the executive director of Habitat for Humanity to come and visit them. When they're going through a divorce, they don't go to the executive director of Habitat for Humanity to visit them, where they do those things with their pastor, possibly. And so if there's going to be money in the way of that I think can be an unnecessary hurdle. Out of the other side of my mouth real quick, I also know how, like, who's the people who show up early and who stay late and who do the dishes when everybody else is leaving. And I know the people who, so I do have formed opinions about how much people give to the church, even though I don't know how much they give financially. So I don't have a strong argument either way, and I'm fine not knowing.
Yeah, I think For me, I worked in a very small church where there was a small number of people that kind of funded the entire operation. And the head pastor would, you know, I would do the kind of the QuickBooks, and he would ask like, "We good?" you know, and for that week. And I was like, "We good?" And he just go, "Oof." But that was a whole different dynamic. If you could have churches design or make one major adjustment to their physical plant, and I'm using a technical term here, what's one thing that churches should have more of in terms of their physical apparatus?
Like the buildings itself, yeah, and the campus.
Yeah.
So somebody said once a while ago that church campuses have personalities, and that some church campuses are very welcoming and some are not. And one example, the church that I was at that before the one that I'm at now was very welcoming. It was like a park-like setting, open, no gates, and the sanctuary was in the middle of the campus, and there was just trees and easily accessible in the middle of the neighborhood, and our neighbors walked through the campus all the time, walked their dogs, and it was just a very hospitable campus. The campus that I'm at now, the Big Red Church, also in the middle of the neighborhood, but it is hard to figure out, other than how to get into the sanctuary, how to get into the campus. It is not a hospitable campus. And so just because there's just walls surrounding the campus. And so I love a hospitable campus with outdoor space that is easily accessible, not just for the congregants, but anybody in that neighborhood. Hmm.
I want to talk a little bit about politics and church. When I was living in Pasadena, I went to this famous Episcopal church, All Saints, and at the doorway, it was fascinating. They would have political petitions for you to sign on your way out. Mm. It was the most aggressively political church I've ever attended, just with the, you know, suggestions for your ballot box, if you will, just, you know, said from the pulpit. And, you know, so I've seen that, but I've also seen kind of the other side of the coin, you know, more conservative churches advocating for political positions, whether it's Roe v. Wade stuff or whatever it might be. Do you think we should all aim to kind of keep politics out of the church community, or should each different kind of wing, according to their political persuasion, be active in the things that interest them? What's your ideal mean here?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of people, including myself, that have no constitutional law background, like to quote separation of church and state. And so I'm definitely politically active, and I'm public about a lot of public political positions, specifically local issues is what I'm most involved in. However, I was actually just right before this, right outside Costa's office with a group of other Christians praying for ceasefire. And so the way that I navigate church and politics is, as a pastor, I am very active in politics, and I take that work as sacred work. The things that I'm conscious about is, one, that kind of work is more prophetic. I couldn't remember that word. It is more prophetic work, and it would kind of be designated that in the practice. But my title is not prophet. My title is pastor. And kind of back to my analogy with money, that politics, I would hate for politics to get in the way of me being a good pastor to somebody, especially in the most difficult moments in their life. My church is an open and affirming congregation, which means we strive to be radically hospitable to folks, especially those who have been ostracized from churches traditionally. And I do wonder what it means to be open and affirming to people who have political views that are significantly different than my own. Do I want them to feel welcome and hospitable also? So I would certainly never endorse a candidate from the pulpit. I, in rare occasions, if the mission of a policy lined up to the mission of our church, I would figure out ways, probably not from the pulpit, to overtly support that, maybe in some kind of something during the week. But I try and be pretty conscious of anything that I would overtly support from the pulpit.
Okay. This next question is kind of related, but different in some ways. And I've kind of got mega churches in the back of my mind when I'm asking this. Do you think there should be some kind of disclosure requirements for receiving tax exemption status from the government? You know, so if you're building, you know, 600 like mega plush campuses with, you know, children's facilities that would rival, you know, some of the best public schools in the United States, and, you know, paying head pastors exorbitant sums, which, you know, is pretty verifiable at this point. Do you think there should we all get to know that as people that are kind of funding that through their tax exemption status?
I'm so glad you asked this, because I have been waiting for a soapbox to stand on to, one, respond to the general call to make churches for profit, because it's just, churches are nonprofit organizations. They're run by a board of directors. There's not one person who profits off or owns the buildings. The organization does. And so for all, just like MoMA, or the Philharmonic, where these nonprofit organizations, there's a lot of money going into them, and oftentimes they don't serve the good of the majority of the community, they still have nonprofit status. And so, one, I'll get to specifically your answer. I do think churches deserve nonprofit status. I think just legally it lines. But churches do have a, and not just Christian churches, but any faith organization, synagogue, mosque, or somebody could come up with their own religious denomination and call it and get the same status. We do not have to disclose some of the information that every other nonprofit organization has to disclose. Not every other, the majority of. And so for me, that doesn't seem fair. And I think that we should be held to the same standard as any other nonprofit organization. So, and I don't think that should be based off of how much money, what the income is for the church itself. I think just anyone getting nonprofit status, there should be a 990 form that is accessible for anyone. I do, clergy do get a tax exempt, and I do not complain about that. I also have no clue how that makes sense to anyone. Like you're a public school teacher?
I'm a public school librarian, yeah.
Okay, so you're a public school librarian. I don't get why you don't deserve a tax exempt housing allowance or anything like that. So if there has been attempts to come for that, and somehow it's continued to hold up in court, and I'm not mad at it as somebody who's benefiting from it, but I totally get the argument of why it is unfair.
Okay. We're going to take a break from these heavy questions and go into my favorite section, which is called overrated versus underrated. I'll throw a bunch of things at you. Tell me whether you think they're overrated or underrated and why. We'll kind of go through this quickly and rapid fire.
I was hoping that this was going to be just local people and you were going to ask me, yes. You're going to say a name.
Yes. I'm just going to name every major member of the clergy in town, and you can tell me whether you think they're over or underrated.
They know. I tell them to their face.
All right. First one, D-Men's, over or underrated?
I'm in the middle of where I'm at the tail end of one right now.
You think they're underrated then, because you're in one?
It is overrated in terms of what it will do for you in the long run. And I think a lot of us think, oh, I went to seminary and did a Master's of Divinity, which is a big behemoth of a program. I'll do that again. But we're now also doing a full-time job that we didn't have before. So I would say overrated.
Okay. Next one. Pews, over or underrated?
There's a nostalgia to them. They are definitely uncomfortable. Fortunately for me, I don't really have to sit in them. But I think that they are more aesthetic than the normal church, those church chairs that they usually have.
Which I had to stack as a child, as the child of a church planter. I had to stack those every Sunday. And I would miss a line, kind of the hooks, and then I'd have to unstack and restack. So this is a personal traumatic moment. Let's just move on to the next one, because I don't want to go too deep in the trauma. Next one, N.T. Wright, over or underrated?
Overrated. Maybe not now, but probably like 10 years ago, I would say he was overrated as... Like, I don't know if his work will stand the test of time compared to maybe other New Testament scholars, but I'm also not, like, I don't think of myself as a biblical scholar, so I'm sure that people who are biblical scholars would disagree with me, and I would defer to them, but yeah, I don't know if he will stand up.
Okay.
Stand the test of time.
Next one, Me and Ed's Pizza.
There's no good pizza in this town. And so Me and Ed's deserves to have their domination because of just their consistency. But if any good pizza maker came to town, Me and Ed's would not be able to stand up. So I will say they are underrated for their ability to understand the Central Valley consumer.
Okay. Next one, a book of the Bible, Deuteronomy. Is it over or underrated?
Underrated. Probably wow. Most books in the Old Testament for Christians that call it the Old Testament, most books are underrated because there's this identity that the God of the New Testament is a sweet, kind Fred Rogers God, and the God of the Old Testament is cruel and vindictive. But Deuteronomy is the story of what it means to live in liberation, to live alongside the God of liberation, and to deal with the trauma of 400 years of Egyptian slavery, and coming to know this God that has liberated them. And so, yes, I would say underrated.
Okay, fantastic. Next, either or, wafers, bread, or crackers?
Oh, bread, for sure. I am over half. Oh, Allison, shout out to Allison.
Yeah.
Yes, I think I actually have had a bread room communion, so...
Okay.
But I think I'm over intinction, or I'd like a break from intinction. There's something that I miss about the passing the tray down the aisle.
Yeah. Next one, the 3-point sermon.
Overrated. Oh, why? Like, you have to preach your style. Hmm. And so maybe a 3-point sermon is helpful if you're learning something is helpful to plug in components, but I think story arc is a much more valuable format to use than the 3 points.
Yeah, I remember when I was in my preaching seminar, they were really advocating for the 3-point thing. But then I found this, I forget his name, he was some minister from the South. And I think he had a book of sermons called like the Cherry Orchard or something like that. I'm forgetting his name, but his sermons are just winding stories. And you just got almost like, you know, like some of my favorite short story writers where I'd get lost in the story. And at the end, the punchline would just like stab you in the gut. Like you just get caught off guard. And those were the most powerful for me. But I understand when you're starting out, it's like teaching kids to write a 5-paragraph essay. Yeah. Next one, another. This is a section of the Bible, the pastoral epistles.
Overrated. I think the majority of the epistles are overrated in the sense that they have shaped our dogma and our doctrine in ways and in more than the gospels that tell the story of Jesus's life. So I would say overrated.
All right, let's jump back into our church questions. What would Christian ministers gain from hanging out with a bunch of rabbis?
Well, one, they would understand books like Deuteronomy, and they would understand the nuance that Judaism really, I think, flourishes. That things like the Talmud and practice ways of reading the Bible that Christendom has strayed away from, especially Christians that have a doctrine and dogma, that there's already an answer for what our questions are in the Bible, as opposed to, I think, the rabbinic tradition is, while there's plenty of answers, there's so much art, there's just great arguments. They know how to argue, and they know how to debate, and they know how to argue and debate and still stay together. Where Christians, we argue and debate, and then we break up.
Christians invented schism.
Hence the Reformation. Schism, the OG Reformation. So, yeah, I think there's also something about we're a baby religion, and we could learn a thing or two from those who have been through it for millennia and are still at it.
Let's say you were kind of designing some kind of work evaluation form, and you had to look for one attribute in different church staff work that showed their effectiveness. I want you to go through three different kinds of jobs, what you would look for in performance: a worship minister, a children's minister, and a youth pastor. What's one sign in each of those jobs that you would look for in terms of effectiveness?
All right. So by worship minister, I'm assuming you mean like somebody whose primary job is music.
Yeah.
That the best is if they are a singer-songwriter, and or they have the creativity to connect with singer-songwriters, and they don't. While I love hymns that are hundreds of years old or over 100 years old, everything since I probably have a difficult time with, and usually because artistically where Christians are so far behind. So I would say, so one, if they're like a singer, not just a singer-songwriter, but somebody that who could play music, who gigs during the week. Could they gig during the week outside of the church? And especially, I'll tread lightly as I say this, but, you know, historically, the Black church has created music that shaped Motown and hip hop, and the white church has not done that in a long, long, long time. All we've done is tried to steal from culture. So that's
why you're telling me Carmen is a little overrated.
Just a beautiful looking man, though.
I saw him in an arena as a kid.
I think he's a beautiful man. Okay, what was the other position?
Children's pastor and a youth pastor.
Children's pastor has some also connection to what is going pedagogically in academia, like new forms of pedagogy, and is creative and artistic that kids can run around. When a kid feels like they belong somewhere when they can run in that place. When my kids were little, I'd take them to the park, and as soon as they would get in the park gates, they would start running. When I'd take them to the zoo, as soon as we got through the zoo gates, they would start running. But for some reason, when kids come to church, they need to sit down and shut up and be quiet. And we need children's ministers that can get kids running and laughing and music moving around. And then the last position?
Youth pastor.
Also, I'm acknowledging that somebody in HR would listen to everything I'm saying. It's like, none of these things can...
It's whatever.
A youth pastor, they are really good at... They're like a community organizer. They build leaders in kids, and they're like a good community organizer. They build leaders in the youth, and they let those youth lead the show. Too many of us, myself included, we depended on our own charisma that we might be able to muster, and we made it a show about ourselves. And that's something that I would have done a much better job of, is really empowering the leader of the leadership of students, and especially looking out for the ones who maybe they the ones who don't flourish athletically or artistically. They're not leaders of the marching band or the star athlete, but at church they thrive, and to create a place for them to thrive and to lead and invite others would be really beautiful. Again, I don't know how that would fit on a form, but I'm sure I could distill it.
Okay, here's a really simple one. Let's say someone's an active participant in your church community, and they said to you one day, you know, I love participating in this Christian community. I think that the Bible, there's no factual information. It's just a bunch of metaphors. Do you think that someone like that has a place in a Christian community?
Well, so I'm the pastor of the First Congregational Church of Fresno, aka the Big Red Church. And there have been a number of people who've come up to me since I started here in November who have told me that exact thing. And a few of them are on our church council. Like they're on the leadership. So in liberal or progressive Christianity, that is not abnormal for somebody to belong to a church and be critical in the academic sense of the Bible. And also the reality is a lot of the Bible is metaphor and was intended to be metaphor. None of it was intended to be scientific, and it was definitely pre-Enlightenment. And so none of it was intended to be scientific. I think probably the goal for me, how I would want to respond to that as a pastor, is to talk about how the Bible might not be scientifically true, yet truth still is found within it. And there's a difference between how we expect the newspaper to be true, factually true, like they're legally obligated to be factually true, and it's a different medium that we're talking about when we talk about the Bible. But to not write it off for the truth that lies within.
Okay. The next question is about two hobby horses of mine and two things that could be changing our understanding of what humans are. The first one is all the flying saucers that are flying around the planet, and we're capturing on increasingly. I mean, I'm fully convinced that they have close up zoomed in pictures, and you can see little fingers or something sticking out the windows or something. They're just not know that we're not ready for it. I probably am not mentally ready for it. So there's that going on. And then there's a lot of new kind of cutting edge research in neurobiology about kind of free will being an illusion. So I guess my question is, let's say that there are, flying saucers or something extraterrestrial flying around, and free will is an illusion. How do each of those respective things change religion for you? Or do they change religion?
I mean, okay, so from the earliest biblical text that we have, so much has been discovered. And like the technology that we have, if we would have had it 5,000 years ago, it would have we would have been burned at the stake as well, not witches, but whatever the equivalent would be. So again, I think it goes back to what I was saying before about the Bible, is that the truths that exist in the Bible don't rely on, and I would say the same is true with any major religion, like any religion that has lasted millennia, the truth that has held up within it is not going to be changed by new discoveries. You might have to say more if I'm going to give you a better answer around the free will component of
well, just that free will is an illusion, that our consciousness is just observing our actions and we're not the authors of our autonomy.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of Christian doctrine that would line up with that as well. And that would point to like, oh, well, that was God's direction. And
well, definitely some Presbyterians that are really strong Calvinists would be excited about that prospect. They'd say he was right. The guy in Switzerland knew what he was talking about.
or at least the people who came after him, really.
Yeah, there you go. Okay. A couple Fresno questions before we wrap up. If you went to a denominational conference, let's say on the East Coast or something, and someone asked you to describe the Fresno church landscape, how would you describe it to them?
Yeah. So I don't know who came up with this first, but we are the Bible Belt of the West Coast. And so I think that's a key component of our context. And even the mainline churches, other Presbyterian churches, Methodist churches, Lutheran churches, they have been so influenced by evangelicalism. Every church in America has been significantly influenced by evangelicalism, but so much more here in Fresno. And so even the mainline churches, maybe polity wise, they are mainline. Like the way that they deal with, the way that they make decisions is the same as a Presbyterian church on the East Coast, but we're so much more evangelical in our theology. You know, there's also the California casualness to it. I think that has a component to it. And California frontier, like we are not loyal to our East Coast sister and brothers. We've escaped them. So yeah, I think I could have probably just stopped as the Bible Belt of the West Coast.
Yeah, I think that sums it up. This was something I was going to ask you in the general section, but I think it's true too in town, where you have kind of at least my, you know, casual perception of the city and the religious kind of breakdown is that there's a lot of like segregation amongst, you know, more progressive and more conservative churches. I'm curious, you know, because I try to be epistemologically humble myself, you know, and not assume that I know everything. What's one area where you think you might be wrong about something and conservative churches might be right?
That's a good question. I actually invited another pastor named Bob Willis, who he would identify as conservative evangelical. And I invited him to my church, the church that I started called Woven Community. And we did an event called Beef with Bob. And Bob came and he shared what he thought was wrong with conservative evangelical churches. And I shared what was wrong with progressive or liberal churches. We are really good at caring about polity that affects millions of people, but we struggle with caring about one person. Like conservatives are much better with giving the shirt off their back.
So like personal philanthropy versus like advocating for, you know, distributive redistribution at the tax system or something like that.
Right. And so I think we probably spend too much time. We could spend more time caring about the individual people around us and having compassion for them eye to eye and caring for them in a way that conservative evangelicals are really good at.
What's one lesson that you learned about how not to do church with Woven?
I did not care if we grew in size when we first started. It wasn't about numbers. It was about creating a place for anybody who might not feel like they belong. And I thought that focusing on growth was gross and capitalistic, and what we missed out on was that the first part of hospitality is always invitation, and you cannot be hospitable if you don't invite people to join you. And there are still, I think, plenty of people who really could have used the community that we had at Woven, but never heard about us because we didn't prioritize reaching out in a way that would connect with them. And so there's a lot of ways to do outreach wrong, but I think it can be done in a way that is genuine and is not just capitalistic. That's not about self, that's not based on self-preservation. When churches are doing things for self-preservation, that's when it's gross.
Yeah.
When we're doing it because we want to care for the people around us and we want to create a bigger table, that's when it's hospitable and beautiful.
Okay. One question I always ask people is how their particular industry, their, you know, activities influence the way they see the city. So I work in education, so I tend to look at things through education problems and solutions. What is what you do inform how you see Fresno?
Well, so here at the Big Red Church, it is a small island for people who think progressively to belong. A small island in this town where they can belong. And there's people who do not fit the dominant narrative of the city that show up here every Sunday. And so I know about a Fresno that exists that gets lost because of what the dominant narrative of the city is. And it's this dominant narrative been shaped by conservative evangelicals. And so I know about people who have had to live in secrecy. And if they're not living in secrecy, then they're living in the Tower District. And yeah, and so there's just this part of Fresno that is a minority, and I think is underrated for sure.
Yeah. Well, and you guys are the kind of one block stop with Reclaim right down the street from you. There's all sorts of help that people that are on the outside can receive just being in that area.
Yeah. And I mean, I think also with like, not just theologically, but just, it's a way of thinking, like Carlos moving in and doing Moto, and Jeff, I can't remember, Jeff's wife starting Ampersand. Like, we're a neighborhood where the things that wouldn't flourish anywhere else in Fresno will flourish. Now Ampersand now flourishes in other places, but yes, if they would have started out there on Herndon and whatever that is, I don't think that they would have had the success that they did. Their ice cream is delicious, don't get me wrong, but there is something about our neighborhood, Fresno High neighborhood and Tower, that has a magic to it that the rest of Fresno don't get to see.
Yeah, the laboratory for different. Yeah, no, for sure. We always close with book recommendations. What are a few books you'd recommend to listeners?
I've been using Black Liturgies by Cole Arthur Riley during Lent, and I got to see Arthur Riley in St. Simon, Georgia, which I think is a great name for an island. And I think that she has this ability to take a lot of Christian tradition. I don't know if she would consider herself Christian or what she would consider herself. And she is able to make it relevant in a way that is so needed and so authentic. And more importantly, like what she's done with her work is to say the Black voice has been missing in crafting liturgy for too long, and she has created space for Black voices to lead the people, and so I cannot recommend this book or her book before This Year Flesh. So yeah, I'll make that both books my recommendation.
Perfect. So where can people find out more about your church community and what times can they show up to attend a service?
We've got a very classic older church website, bigredchurch.org, that you can fumble through. And we have a worship service 10 a.m. on Sundays, and that is clean and crisp and traditional. It is an hour that you will go without a screen. We've got no screens in our sanctuary, and so come and take a break from a screen. I also can I plug Woven Coalition? Woven Coalition is a nonprofit that myself and a group of us started. Des Washington, who I believe was on the show before, uh-huh, on the cast before. So we've created an organization to get more people involved in social justice work around local issues. And we're particularly interested in how do we get people who aren't directly impacted by justice issues to stand alongside those who are. And so wovencoalition.org has a website that hopefully is easier to navigate.
Okay. Final question. Did you give up something for Lent?
I never have. I haven't given up anything for Lent, and I haven't taken up anything for Lent. So Easter will be really lackluster for me.
Well, I appreciate you talking with me, Simon. This has been great. And yeah, I love what you're doing in our community.
Thanks, Jordan. Appreciate the time.
Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, you can support this podcast by leaving us a rating and review, or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/Fresno's Best. We'll see you next time.